Okay, Daniel 9, verse 20 to 27. Daniel is the Old Testament parallel of Revelation. It deals with some specific prophecies. Even though all the prophets had some prophecies going on, most of them are short term. Daniel 9, verse 24 to 27 is probably the number one prophecy of the Bible. This is God's calendar for the two earthly appearances of Jesus Christ. He's laid it out for us. When you can expect the first and second coming of Christ as far as this calendar system. Our calendar system's all messed up, so that's the problem with ours. We're going to pick up in verse 20 and read down through 27 and come back in verse 24 and go through it very slowly. He says this, "And whilst I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yea, whilst I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding." So this is one of the two angels in the Bible that's named Gabriel and Michael. Michael shows up, he's always beating somebody up. Gabriel's showing up, he's telling somebody something. So he has the gift of gab. That's where that came from. Okay, and so he's delivering the messages from God to Daniel. Verse 23, "At the beginning of thy supplication, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, understand the matter and consider the vision. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, upon thy holy city, to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Now therefore, know therefore, and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince," notice uppercase P, Prince, Messiah, uppercase M, "shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. A score is 20, so 62 plus 7, 69. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince," lowercase p, so this is the counterfeit, this is the Antichrist, "shall come and shall destroy the city and the sanctuary," or a type of the Antichrist. "And the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the wars desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate." Okay, let's go ahead and pray. Lord, I do ask you to help us to understand this. I pray that the Spirit of God would guide us and direct us, that we'd give us understanding, inspire our minds so we might understand the words. And I pray that this would be a time of excitement to recognize that the God of the Bible is all-powerful, but yet he's merciful. And this God has laid out a calendar system for us to understand and to see what's happening in time. I pray you'd help us to get this. In Jesus' name, amen. I was just thinking also that come late April, early May, I got Sam Gipp scheduled for us. And I might have him preach his one message in the afternoon, what you're going to be doing on the day of the rapture. And it's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. I listened to him over at Hope. So I said, hey, you got to come over when you come over and do that one. And so that's a very interesting thought. But in Daniel 9, the reason why God showed all this stuff to Daniel, it says he was beloved. Now, if you think about it, okay, Daniel is at least 85 years old when he got this prophecy. How do I know that? Chapter 9, verse 1 and 2, he was reading some words that Jeremiah wrote about 70 years of captivity. He ran the calendar. He had been a prisoner, or not a prisoner, but he'd been a subject under Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar for almost 70 years. And he was a teenager when he was taken prisoner. And then he was, they tried to brainwash him for 3 years. They made him a eunuch. So this guy went through a lot of struggles in life, being taken from his homeland, his parents probably killed in a war. He had no hope of a future family. There's no mention of a marriage in there at all. And he is now a subject under Babylon for almost 70 years. Eventually, he's going to be jumped into Media Persia, be a subject under them. So he's about 85 years old when he was given this revelation. The word prophecy, if you notice it in verse 24, is spelled with a C. That's a noun. With an S, it's a verb, prophesy. With a C, it's a noun. It's like advice. That's a noun, advise. With an S, that's a verb. This is the very first time in the Bible that the word prophecy is found where the prophecy is given in detail. The word prophecy is found other places where so-and-so gave this prophecy, but the prophecy wasn't recorded. It wasn't given at that time. This is a long-term prophecy, and if a person doesn't get this one right, they mess up a lot of Bible. I mean, they get so goofy where they think Jesus came back in 70 A.D. I've had Baptists tell me that. I said, and where's the devil? He's bound. I said, man, he's got a long chain. Okay? And so they're not reading this thing right, that's for sure. This prophecy gives the two, it's God's calendar of the two earthly appearances of Jesus Christ. How did the wise men know about the approximate birth of Christ? Is by this prophecy. This was a calendar. It wasn't the star that tipped them off. The star was simply icing on the cake. They knew this prophecy. It is dating something. And so I'm going to give you some thoughts about this prophetic calendar that God gave here in Daniel 9:24, and we're going to try to run it very quickly, which should take about 2 hours to get all the details. But we're not going to do that. So I'm going to give you three thoughts about it this morning. The first thought is this. The one unique difference of the faith of the Bible and all other religions is the knowledge of the future. Prophesying. There are two unique traits that God has that the devil does not have, as God can create out of nothing. Satan can create, but he has to use some matter that God has in order to create. He can actually produce life, but again, he has to use God's matter to do that. He cannot create out of nothing. The second is God's ability to prophesy through his men. Details, write it down, and then just wait for it to come true. Now, the miraculous thing about it is that God can fulfill his prophecies without crossing the free will of men. He doesn't force people to obey his prophecies. He can do it without forcing people to do it. And there are certain ways how he gets this accomplished. When I went to Israel in 1997, we are on a Temple Mount. It's where the Muslims got the Dome of the Rock and all that stuff. The Jewish guide gave about a 15-minute spiel about Muhammad the prophet. After he got done, I walked up beside Mika and I said, "Hey Mika, you call Muhammad a prophet, right?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Give me one of his prophecies." He smiled and he said, "David, you're thinking." Yeah, that's right. He don't give a prophecy. Ask any Muslim that. Ask him. Don't get in a fight with him. Just say, "You call Muhammad the prophet, right? Does that mean he tells the future?" "Yeah, that's right." "Okay, give me one of his prophecies." "I can give you several of Jesus Christ. I'll give you one right now." Look, if you would, in John 13, verse 19. That is what proves the Bible, is the unique prophecies of the Bible. In fact, in Isaiah 41, God is looking over the entire universe, and he's looking at man as a corporate body, the United Nations, and he's looking at all the pagan gods. He's looking at the god Nike and the god Pan and the god this and the god that, you know, and Zeus and all them, the pagan deities. And he challenges him. He said, "I want you to tell the future so that we can basically be in awe of you. I want you to tell the future." And they can't do it. Not in detail. Not in detail. Satan can predict the future through his horoscopes, tea leaf reading, palmistry. But it's a very general thing. John 13, verse 19, this is what Jesus told his apostles. He had already told them that I'm going to go into Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer many things, I'm going to be crucified, and I'm going to rise from the dead. He gave several times he gave this to them. In John 13, 19, he said this, "Now I tell you before it come, that when it is come to pass, ye may believe that I am he. I am that I am." John 14, 29, he said this, he repeated it to them. John 14, 29, he said this, "And now I have told you before it come to pass, that when it is come to pass, ye might believe." So what we have is a book here that's full of prophecies. They are given details. God has a powerful ability to prophesy in detail. Not a generic prophecy like the sun's coming up tomorrow. Not this Nostradamus stuff where he's had all these prophecies, stick them in a drawer like Gene Dixon, stick them in a drawer, and then one gets it right and they pull it out of the drawer and say, "Well, I predicted that on such and such day." Well, let's look at what else you got in that drawer. None of this generic stuff. It's like a lifer in jail. He gets his horoscope ready. You're going to find the love of your life today. It's a guy down the cell. I mean, what's the thing? Okay, and so God has the amazing ability to predict the future, and it comes true. How does he do this? The devil can counterfeit this. He can counterfeit it generally, but he cannot be specific about it. Both of them have this capability. How is this done? Okay, God makes a statement, he gives the details, and then he will put thoughts in people's minds to fulfill the details. In their mind, they think it's an original thought, and then they act upon it. The day of the crucifixion, that day, the Spirit of God just comes over the soldiers, and they said, "Beat them, beat them, beat them, beat them, beat them," and they beat them. And they'd come over Caiaphas, and they'd come over Pontius Pilate, and they would just, in their mind, they thought they were doing right. In their mind, that's what they thought. But you see, this is a free will thing. If you would look at Revelation 17, 17. God can put these thoughts in the minds of devils or demonic kings. In John 13 or 17, 17, he will put in the mind of 10 federated kings during the tribulation time period, and they will yield their authority to the Antichrist. Revelation 17, 17. I hope I said that. Revelation 17, 17. "For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled." Now, these demonic kings, they did not get up that morning and say, "I'm going to fulfill God's will today. What does God want me to do? Oh, he wants me to yield my kingdom to the Antichrist." No, God can give them thoughts. Satan can give you thoughts. And that's not unusual. Thoughts are just words floating through the air. Words floating through the air. I mean, right now what's going through our head is a bunch of radio programs, a bunch of television programs, all this cell phone information coming through. And if you smoke some weed or snort some coke, you might pick up on several of those things coming through there. Okay, and so these things are floating around. That's why words are like spirits. And these thoughts can come into your mind, and it can affect hundreds of thousands of people at the same time. Have you ever been in a car driving with somebody, and one person said, "Hey, what about," and you said, "I was just thinking about that." The thought came in at the same time. People say great minds can think alike. Yeah, but so can ours. And so you got to think about that one. Okay, so this is how it's done. Now, you know the future by studying the past. That's one way of knowing generally how things work. But God is very detailed. He's very precise in his prophecies. Satan is very generic. He can't get detailed like God can. And here's how the devil does it. Okay, a person goes to a palm reader, and this person puts a thought into their mind. And in their mind, they've already got this thought, so they are now going to try to act out the circumstances that comes true. He'll put a thought in another person's mind, or arrange the circumstances, and often the circumstances will come true, and the person will start trusting this. The devil will tell you the truth at the beginning, and then he will gain your confidence, and then he will start telling you lies. He hooks you in. And that's exactly how all the horoscope and the palm readers and all that stuff. If you're going to go to a palm reader, write in your hand right here, read my palm. You need to get saved. And let them read that, or something like that. Really throw them off. And you'll see their circuit breakers and their eyeballs go, because that's where you study the eyes. So that's the very unique difference of the Bible. The Bible gives detailed prophecies in detail, and then you just sit there and watch them take place through history. Okay, the second thought is this. Because God has given us details of prophecies in the Bible, a person that spends time in the Bible, or at least gets introduced to Jesus Christ, they can know the future to a point. For example, personally, with true faith, one can be certain of his or her destination after death. Death is nothing but the separation of the soul and spirit from the body. It is like a departure. It's nothing, mystical about it. It's when the soul leaves the body, departs the body. In Genesis 35, when Rachel was giving birth, it says that her soul was in departing. When Paul was facing his death, knowing that he was going to die, he said, "My departure is at hand." If you go to the airport, you'll see an arrival gate and a departure gate. If you go to the departure gate, you will see tears of sorrow. Somebody's departing. If you go to the arrival gate, you may see tears of joy. When a saint, when a believer in Jesus Christ dies, their soul departs their body, their spirit departs the body, they step into the invisible world, a parallel universe right beside them. And they can look into the physical world, but we can't look into the spiritual world unless God allows that to happen, and that's a rare thing. And so this person, we have tears of sorrow at the departure gate here, but at the heavens and the portals of heaven, when that person steps into the throne with Jesus Christ, you have tears of joy. Nothing unusual about that. Nothing mystical about that. There have been people who have had heart surgery, and their soul, God allowed their soul to hover above the surgeon, and they watched. And they asked the surgeon why he said such and such at such and such time. What are you talking about? Their soul was in departing, but God allowed them to do a U-turn and came right back in. And you see, it's stepping into the invisible world. If we could see the invisible world, we'd be shocked. Maybe an angel sitting here, maybe a devil sitting here, maybe a devil sitting here. You'd be surprised. Okay, so a person can personally know their destination. If you go to an airport, if you're confused about an airport, it's not shameful to not know where you're going. It's shameful if you don't ask. Okay, so you go to an airport, you're confused about the big things, so you find somebody at work to show me where I need to go. Okay, they direct you where you need to go. You get to the gate of the flight you're going to get on. You're walking on, and you say to the person at the beginning, "Do you know where the destination of this plane is going?" Person says, "I don't know." Okay, flag comes up. You get to board on the airplane. You see the first stewardess there as she is, welcoming you to the airplane. "Do you know where this plane's going?" "I'm not certain." "Let's ask the pilot." You go to the pilot and you ask the pilot, "Sir, do you know the destination of this plane?" No, but we're going to make good time." Who would get on that plane? Who would get on that plane? Nobody in their right mind. Unless you just like to fly. Okay? But the vast majority of people, they go to a church, and if you ask the pilot behind the pulpit, "Do you know where you're going when you die?" "Well, we can hope." You go to the Catholic priest and ask him, "Hey, pal." And they don't like that when you call him pal. Or, "Hey, dad." Short for father. "Do you know where you're going when you die?" "No, we can only hope." "Why would I want to get on that plane? That'd be dumb." And the sad thing is, another one say, "We can just hope to the end, endure." I think I'm going to go someplace where people knows what's going on. I'm going to make a reservation. That's what I'm going to do. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 4, it says that you can make a reservation. It says, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled, and that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you. B-I-B-L-E. You know what that stands for? Be informed before leaving earth. Why would God leave us in the dark? I mean, there's no sense in that. There's no sense going to a religious structure where they don't know where they're going when they die. The Bible is given so that we can know. And thank God for that. And it's not because a person thinks they're good. It's because we recognize, what's the first step to knowledge? Is to recognize you're ignorant. What's the first step to being able to go to heaven? Knowing that I'm a sinner and I need a Savior. And I come to Jesus Christ. There's an elderly gentleman just passed away down in Florida. His name is Brother Mitchell. This man had spent much of his life trying to help and serve a preacher that he had a lot of confidence in, a great Bible teacher by the name of Peter Ruckman. Brother Mitchell was probably, he and his wife were probably the pillars of Pensacola Bible Institute. Brother Mitchell was getting to his death door, and on a Sunday, Dr. Ruckman went to visit Brother Mitchell in the hospital, and Brother Mitchell just says to him, he said, sorry, Doc, I'm taking out. I'm checking out. He's a former Marine. He said, I'm jumping ship on Wednesday. He said, okay. And on Wednesday, he died. The Lord told him when he was going to die. And he knew. He's jumping ship. Ain't that something? You don't hear that nowadays, but the old saints of the old days, they knew. They knew. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that's a successful way to die. When you know, when you're time to check out, man, I got my fight. I'm going on board in that plane. I'm departing out of here. Man, ain't nothing better than that. Now, if you would, go back to Daniel 9, and let's run through this calendar. Daniel 9, verse 24. Now, we have one advantage about this prophecy is we have hindsight. Okay, this prophecy was given to Daniel about 536 B.C. because that's when Media Persia got ready to conquer Babylon. And he knew that they were going to conquer them. In Daniel 5, when he had the handwriting on the wall, he knew that by the calendar. He didn't need to have the handwritten writing on the wall. He knew the calendar system that Media Persia was outside the walls getting ready to conquer them. So our advantage is we have hindsight. Daniel 9:24, 70 weeks. 70 weeks. Now we know, because of hindsight, a week in this context is not 7 days. We know now because of hindsight, this is 7 years is 1 week. 70 sets of 7 years, 490 years. We know that from hindsight now. In the Bible, you have an example where Jacob worked 7 years for Rachel, and then he got hoodwinked that night. He was so drunk, he didn't know who was given to that night. And then he said to his father-in-law, he said, I will serve another week, referring to 7 years, back in Genesis. So 70 weeks in this context will be 70 sets of 7 years. Jesus Christ summarized it when the disciples said, how long do we have to forgive our brethren? He said, until 70 times 7. That's a short version of that. So 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, upon thy holy city. What is that? White Anglo-Saxons in America? The Aryan nations? No, thy people. The context defines it. You can take thy people, go up to verse 15. O now, O Lord our God, that has brought thy people forth out of the land of Egypt. Nothing hard about that. You go down to verse 16, the last statement or phrase, and thy people are become a reproach to all that are about us. And if you drop down to verse 19, again the last phrase, and thy people are called by thy name. So it's a no-brainer. Thy people, Israel. E-L at the end of Israel, God. So thy people, this is something to do with Jewish people. And upon thy holy city, what is that? It ain't Washington, D.C., that's for sure. And it sure isn't Salt Lake City. Okay, it's thy people and thy holy city. If you go up to verse 16, right in the middle of the verse, you will see thy city, Jerusalem, thy holy mountain. If you drop down to verse 19, that middle part of that prayer, oh my God, that's what an atheist will pray if you kick him out of an airplane without a parachute. He says, oh my God, for thy city and thy people are called by thy name. Okay, so verse 24. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. We, the church, the New Testament church, don't even play a role in this. There's nothing difficult about this, except for some people's theology. You have three basic ideas about the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. You have what's called premillennial, where Jesus Christ comes back at the beginning. You've got your postmillennial, where Jesus Christ comes back at the end. And then your amillennial are guys that don't want to commit to anything. Now, a postmillennial is a very positive-minded person. So positive that he thinks the church is getting better and better, so the church can usher this wonderful church in. And Jesus comes back at the end. That guy is not dealing with a full deck. When you look at reality, everything falls apart. The only way your car is staying in good shape is some outside force is trying to preserve it. It is a natural thing of life that everything falls apart. This world is falling apart. This country is falling apart. Why? That's a natural thing. D.L. Moody, the Moody Bible Institute, is not what D.L. Moody started. It's falling apart. Why? That's a natural thing. This world's falling apart and it's going to be in a mess and Jesus Christ will come back and fix it. That's a pre-millennial, logical, biblical approach to the Bible. Okay, pre-tribulation. That means that the church is pulled out before the tribulation when God picks up this 70th week again. He has to pull us out. Why? Verse 24 says, thy people, thy holy city. It did not say Christians. You see, this is the problem with the Left Behind series, is they don't tell you the right doctrine for the tribulation time period. They don't tell you the right doctrine for that. The doctrine of the tribulation has to revert back to Old Testament doctrine. That's why Hebrews writes the way it's written. It has to go back to a faith and work system. How can a born-again believer who has eternal security go into the tribulation and be guilty of taking the mark of the beast, losing her salvation? It can't be done. So he's got to pull us out of here. He's got to pull the believer out of here before he picks this up again. Now there are seven characteristics in verse 24, seven characteristics that will define the end of this calendar. The first one we read, verse 24, the first phrase. This is associated with Jerusalem and the Jews. The second thing, to finish the transgression. Third thing, to make an end of sins. Sins of what? Thy people Israel. To make reconciliation for iniquity. What is that? For the Jews to be reconciled back to God, they got to get a red heifer, take that down to the temple, cut the throat, catch the blood, throw it on the mercy seat, burn that red heifer. And they will be reconciled back to God. The Jews think they have found that red heifer. The Jews are ready to get this started. Then it says, and to bring in everlasting righteousness. That has not happened. And to seal up the vision and prophecy. That has not happened. And to anoint the most holy. That has not happened. So you got to get all seven of those for this to be complete. None of them have happened. Okay, how's the calendar start? Verse 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So why does he split it up like that? 7 weeks, 49 years, that's how long it took them to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Actually, it took them about 2 years to rebuild the walls. It took them 47 years to get the building permits. And you had to get all that through there. Okay, but 49 years for them to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, it says, 7 weeks, that's that part, and then 62 weeks until Messiah the Prince. It says this, the street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous times. Okay, when did this commandment start in verse 25? You'll find it in Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2 is when the king told Nehemiah, you go back and build the walls. That took place in spring of 445 B.C. So you hit that, spring 445 B.C., and then you take 483 years with one hitch in that. You can't go by our calendar. Our calendar's messed up. It's a Greco-Roman calendar or Julian calendar, whatever it is. A Bible prophetic calendar is 360 days. You get that out of Revelation. Revelation, you have 42 months, 1,260 days. 1,260 divided by 42, 30 days in a month. It's a perfect 360 degrees. And that's probably how it was in the Garden of Eden, but then the Lord messed it up with the flood and tilted it and made it 365 and a quarter. So you got to take that and you run the math, and you know when your 69-week stop, the last day? Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday. That's exactly what this said. 7 weeks, 62 weeks, 69 weeks, and then it says in verse 26, after 62 weeks plus the 7, shall Messiah be cut off. How did those people know when Jesus Christ came into Jerusalem, he got the colt, the foal, and ass, and he was riding on this coming in, and he had a royal blanket on top of that thing, and he comes in, and his people throw down his palm. How did they know that that was going to happen? It was a calendar. They knew the calendar. And then it says, after 62 weeks. So after the 483 years, so Sunday, that would have been the final day of 69 weeks. Monday, day 1, 70th week. Tuesday, day 2, 70th week. Wednesday, Jesus Christ was crucified. Day 3 of the 70th week. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, rose from the grave Saturday night. 6 days, he came back for 40 days and 40 nights. So now you got 46 days. Already the sand clock is still going. Why? Because the Lord was still had that clock going because in the book of Acts, he was waiting for the Jews to accept him again. And what did the apostles ask in Acts 1? Are you going to restore the kingdom to us? Good question, pals, but we'll have to wait and see what the Jews do. So how many days of the 70th week are left? More than 3.5. But if somebody wants to make it 3.5, I could care less. People fuss about this stuff. Just a dumb thing to fuss about. If I had a guess, I'd say 2,300 days left. I'd say 220 days possibly where you get to Acts chapter 7 where Stephen given his final message to the Jews and they rejected that message. Right there, God probably picked up that sand clock and cheated and put it on its side. You ever play those games like that little sand clocks? You know, you cheat by putting it on the side. When the kids aren't watching, you put it on your side and you got more time. Hey, Dad! Oh, sorry. Well, God can pick that thing up, put it on its side, and pick it up when he wants. He put us in the church age in as a parenthesis. Why? Because the Jews rejected it in Acts 7. And so after that, it says, in verse 26, after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, crucifixion. But not for himself. He didn't die for himself, he died for sinners. And the people of the prince, lowercase p, we have, again, we have hindsight. The people of the prince, Rome, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. They did that in 70 AD. They're going to do it again in the tribulation time period. After the word sanctuary is a semicolon, and then he jumps into the tribulation and the end. That's famous words in the Bible. The end. The end of what? The end of the 70 weeks. You'll find that end, Matthew 24, 13, he that endureth the end shall be saved. Matthew 24, 21, then shall great tribulation. And then when you see the abomination of desolation, you pick up your cell phone, you look at that, oh, he's going to sacrifice somebody in the Jewish temple. You better run. Of course, it's not us, it's Jews. You better run. Man, we're out of here. The end, that is the end of the 70 weeks. The end there shall be with a flood. That flood is described in Revelation 12. Where the Antichrist, Leviathan, comes up. He sucks up water out of the Jordan River and he spews it out at people as they're running down to Petra, down into Sela Petra, trying to hide from this. And at the end of the war, desolations are determined. Desolations, that's an understatement. It's going to be so desolate in Israel, he even actually calls Jerusalem or Israel desolate in Isaiah 62, verse 4, where it's a capital D. He titles it desolate. So what's going to happen? 27, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. He, Antichrist, he's going to make an agreement for a seven-year deal. Peace treaty with the Jews for 7 years. But you see, the Muslims have a doctrine called Hudna, where the maximum that they can agree with something is 10 years. After 10 years, anything goes. And so he's going to make an agreement for 1 week, and in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. So he's going to make an agreement with the Jews, 7-year agreement, but in the middle, 3.5 years, or at that time period, he's going to say, stop, I'm God, worship me. And the Jews that recognize this are going to recognize that he's now the devil, not the Messiah. And they will reject that. He will say, kill them. Catch their blood. He'll drink their blood in a sacrifice. Flay them. And he'll eat their body in a sacrifice. That's the abomination of desolation. You say, that's wild. Yeah, there's a church in town that just pretended it this morning. They pretended to eat Jesus this morning. What's so wild about that? Now, I don't believe that. It says, so the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abomination, she shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and the determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Okay, now, if you just look at the world as a whole, here's what you see. You go to the Bible, and you say, the Bible makes these predictions. Then you go to the world and say, well, let's see how this world's doing with these predictions. You don't go to the world, then go to the Bible and try to make the Bible match the world. So what do we see? Do you see that vampirism is accepted now in the church? Do you see that? I mean, the Mormons have used these two vampires to be teaching great morals to their young people. The Catholic Church has approved of Rowling's books and Harry Potter. See, vampirism has been accepted. Cannibalism is being endorsed. In fact, you'd be surprised with what's being used with the fetus, the cells of the fetuses, of food flavoring in our country. Okay, and in the Chinese country, what are they doing with the aborted babies? Eating them. Okay, and so this is being endorsed. Now zombies is still out there yet, but that they're going to kind of keep that out there for a particular reason. But you see, that is being pushed. Not only do we see that, but we also see the New World Order has prepared world government leaders for one leader to take charge. The first Jewish or the first Jesuit pope is now preparing the world for acceptance of a one-world religion. An economic collapse can be ushered in at any time. Anytime. I mean, when the fake currency is all fake, it's all currency, it's just a facade, the bankers can pull the plug anytime they want. And so the economic collapse will usher in a need for electronic funds. And so people will buy into that. The number 666 has been conditioning people to accept this control for years. The monster drink, the three squiggly lines, is how a Jew writes 666. And it's lime green, you'll find out in Revelation 16. The world, they can't get away from this book. This book tells you what's going to happen. This book is a fascinating book. If you're going to take some time and watch the halftime show today, Take note of the worship of Satan. It most likely will happen just like it did with Madonna and Beyonce during the halftime show of the football games where they worship their God. They make it quite evident. Madonna's was so obvious. I mean, you talk about Pharaoh coming in and marching in and worshiping their God. You talk about it was right in your face. Getting that out in the millions of people's thoughts. And people, generally speaking, people today are ready for a revolution. Americans have become so apathetic politically because they know you can't do anything. And they're primed for a revolution. The Ukraine is going through one right now. And you're going to find it everywhere. And the Antichrist is going to be so slick that he will come in and have a revolution. But yet he will deceive the people thinking that he has their best interest at heart. That is a masterful tactician of somebody who can control people without them knowing that he's controlling them. It's an amazing thing. And the world is set for a revolution. I mean, the world is setting all these things up. God has all planned. I mean, he's put all the little pieces together. It's a phenomenal thing. When you step back and look at this Bible, you got to look at the God of that Bible and say, that God is powerful. And you got to worship that God, recognizing his masterful plan. God has a master. He's not alarmed. He's not in heaven saying, I can't believe this is happening. He's got a masterful plan to set the world, and he is setting up the world so he can have the greatest special effects ever known to man. I mean, come on, men. What do you like in war movies? You like special effects, right? And so the Lord is setting this up where the Antichrist comes up, and the Battle of Armageddon, and he's going, pow, like that. And it is going to be the greatest show on earth. And Jesus Christ is going to be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he's got it set out for us in the calendar system. Now, when it's going to happen, who knows? Sooner the better. That's for sure. But the bottom line is, the God of this Bible is mighty, but the God of this Bible is also merciful. He may show you this world events, but he also can show each of us individually your destination. You don't have to be in the dark on that. And that's the greatest thing about this Bible. Another example on this idea, did you know that our government has a mark, M-A-R-C? They have been experimenting with this for 30 years. A mark is defined to be, let's see if I get it. That's Walmart. A multiple automated readout chip. And guess where they discovered that this is the best place to put it? Right there, and right there, miraculously. Our government has a computer they call the Beast. The words stand for Battle, Engagement, Area, Simulation, and Tracking. And Walmart, for years, have been putting little chips in their clothing, RFID, radio frequency IDs. They've been doing this for years. Eventually, they can get to the point where you don't even need a cash register. You just walk in, take it off the shelf, and scan it in. Go out, put your hand on there. There you go. You see? And that's the idea. You see, this is what the Lord is setting up, all these things, setting them up just masterfully. But the thing is people say, well, it's amazing man's technology. All he's got to do is throw some electronic bomb, and he'll shut everything off. The God of this Bible, all he has to do is send one meteorite to shoot off all the satellites, and he can shut everything down anytime he wants. That's all God has to do. The amazing thing about the God of the Bible is his might, but yet he's merciful. What an extreme. He's mighty because he is going to bring this in no matter what anybody thinks, and he's merciful. He's letting us know about it. He's letting us know, and he let us in on the game. Okay, let's pray. Lord, I do pray you'd help us recognize the God of the Bible, a powerful God, amazing God, yet he doesn't cross our free will. He will not cross our free will. And Lord, I pray that by chance, if somebody sitting here is not certain of their destination upon death, that they would not be ashamed to at least ask about that. The shame is not asking. And Lord, I pray they might know for certain that they're going to heaven when they die. And the believers, I pray, Lord, that you'd help us just to be in awe of thee. To be in awe of thy word. To be in awe of thy power. To step back and look at this blessed book and say, wow, what a book this is. And help us to love you more. Well, heads are bowed and eyes are closed. The piano will play. The altar's open if you need it. If you're uncertain or do not know about your destination upon death. Of course, we'd be glad to show you that in the Bible. That ye may know that ye have eternal life. No guesswork, no hoping. It's a guarantee of faith in Jesus Christ. Lord, thank you for a blessed book you've given us. Lord, I do pray you'd help us to understand it better and help us to recognize that you are a God who has power and might. And when we rest in that power and that might, and we can rest in thee. Great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. This Bible promises. And Lord, I just pray you'd help us to rest in your power and your might. In Jesus' name, amen.